Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner, and I'm about to do an interview with a founder whose company you don't know, but I assure you it's a massively successful site. And I'm also going to tell you that once you get to know this company, you're going to realize that you've actually seen a lot of the stories that they've broken, probably didn't realize it. His name is Fred. The founder's name is Fred Muwanga Gahunga.
That's right.
Did I get it right?
You did.
Let me say it again like a man and not like a questioning child. Muwanga Gahunga.
That's right. Gahunga. That's it.
How would you pronounce it?
I would say Muwanga Gahunga.
Okay. And you're from Uganda, right? That's where the name came from?
Yeah, my parents were born in Uganda. I'm from New York, though.
Cool. And the company is Media Takeout. It's an online gossip site. And as I said, you're going to see that a lot of the stories that you've read about actually originated or were about Fred's site. I want to find out how he built it up. I want to understand, can content really be profitable in a world today where it feels like advertising is being controlled by a couple of companies, where it's tough to get anyone to come to your site, and where everyone seems to just be on social networks? And I want to understand how he built up his business. This interview is sponsored by two companies you know. The first will help you hire your next phenomenal developer. It's called TopTal. And the second will help you send out marketing emails properly. It's called ActiveCampaign. But I'll tell you guys more about them later. Fred, welcome.
Welcome. Good to be here.
Hey, how much traffic are you guys doing now per month?
So we're doing about 30 million uniques, and that averages to about around 300 million page views a month.
And I actually first saw you, but didn't realize that I saw your site in the Rihanna photos. Chris Brown hit Rihanna. There were photos of her bruised face. I'm looking at them now. They still give me pain to watch them.
Yeah.
I didn't notice at the time. There was a big watermark on them, all over them. And the watermark said?
MediaTakeout.com.
And because of that, TMZ, when they reported on the news and showed the photos, they showed MediaTakeout.com. Everyone else showed MediaTakeout.com. Was that your first big hit?
I think that was probably our kind of – we were always kind of bubbling up, and you know, we kind of had a niche. We were a niche player. And when we broke that story, it kind of crossed over. Just to give you a little bit of background, MediaTakeout, we deal in primarily urban celebrity gossip. So most of our celebrities are African-American. And at the time, most of our audience was African-American too. But every once in a while, there's a story that kind of crosses from, you know, everyone is interested in. And so that was sort of one of it. We've been covering Chris Brown and Rihanna ever since they started dating. And the big blow up happened. And we were actually the first place to break the actual assault. And then eventually we got the photo images and we posted them too.
And you said a tipster sent it to you. How does something like this happen? Is it just some random person who sends it over?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, for that one specifically, it was a person that had the photos and they were trying to get it out. And I think they were trying to sell it to a couple of places. They weren't able to sell the photos to the places that they wanted to. And they were just basically like, as a screw you to the places that were bathing, they sent it to us. We were happy to take it.
And it was just that they were fans of yours and you didn't have to pay.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't have to pay for those photos.
It's phenomenal for a guy whose background had nothing to do with this. You went to school to learn to do what?
I went to law school and business school, so certainly don't have a gossip background.
And you told our producer, you know what, I'm not the kind of person, if you're looking for a story of childhood where I sold pencils and I made money and I knew I was always going to be an entrepreneur, that's not me. So who were you then back then?
Okay, so I mean, I think I always knew that I wanted to work. I mean, I came from a very humble immigrant home, and so if I wanted anything, I actually had to go out and work and earn it. So I started working when I was about 12 years old. I started off delivering papers. And shortly after that, I started working for a videographer who videotaped weddings. And I did that from sort of 13 through high school into college.
Did you do Donald Trump's wedding?
I did.
You did. Donald Trump. You got to see behind the scenes stuff there. What'd you see there?
Nothing. There was nothing big there. I mean, it was Donald Trump and Marla Maples. There wasn't really a ton there. I mean, it was a big, beautiful wedding at one of his grand hotels. Tons of celebrities were there. For me, it was kind of an easy job because it was such a big job. They had so many people there. I was kind of just sitting around and, you know, twiddling my fingers. But, you know,
how did they keep someone like you, by the way, who has cameras, from taking photos and sneaking them out? What do celebrities do to avoid that?
Well, I mean, you really can't. do anything to kind of stop that from happening. And in fact, on that day, one of the people that I work with actually did take a camera and snuck a photograph and actually sold it to the tabloids. So for something like that, you really can't stop it. I mean, you make people sign documents and whatever else, but if they're going to sell it and they're going to sell it under an anonymous name, you can't stop that from happening.
Okay, so you did that, and then you had an idea for Laundry Spa, which I can't find photos of it, but I found like a New York Post article about it, or New York Daily News. People were there it is. New York Daily News wrote a post about it back in 2005 about how wonderful it was to get their laundry back.
Yeah, I mean, it was good. So the idea was, I mean, at the time I was working as a lawyer on Wall Street, and so most of my clothes were sent out to the laundry. But the problem is, you know, I had clothes that I needed laundered, like underwear and undershirts, and then I needed clothes that I needed dry cleaned, like suits. But then you have these clothes kind of in the middle, right? Like a nice sweater, maybe a nice pair of jeans that aren't necessarily stuff that you want laundered, just kind of thrown into a laundromat, into a laundry machine without anyone actually thinking about it. But they're not necessarily dry clean items. I mean, you don't want to spend $5 or $6 to dry clean that simple piece. So the idea was you had this kind of hole in the market. And so that's exactly what we did. The kind of selling point for us was where we'd read all the labels and and wash them exactly as the label said. So if it was hand wash, we hand washed it. If it was line dry, we line dried it. If we said wash cold, we wash cold. And that added a lot more to the kind of process. But in the end, the people were able to get a better product.
And it was mostly an online business, is that right?
Yeah, it was all online. I mean, we had a giant factory that was doing all the laundry, but
part of the business or contracted out?
No, we owned it all. I mean, eventually we got so big that we had to contract out a large part of it. But that was the idea.
What'd you sell the business for?
I don't want to say.
Did you become a millionaire at that point?
At that point, I did very, very well. But I was also like 30 years old. So it was, you know, even if someone gives you $1 million at 30 years old, what are you going to do? You're not going to like, you know, start a foundation with it. I knew I still had to go to work. I did well on it. I probably didn't do as well as I should have. I mean, part of the thing, and even to this day, it still kind of gets me, right? Because the idea that I did when I got into that business was, you know, when you look around and you look at, you know, the businesses of the 80s. So in the 80s, you saw a lot of drug stores, you saw a lot of hardware stores, you saw a lot of, and all those stores kind of got kind of consolidated into these giant conglomerates, right? Like you don't see any drug store that's not a CVS or Walgreens or something like that. You don't see any hardware store that's not a Home Depot, right? And so, but you still have these laundry mats and you still have these dry cleaners, right? Whoever you are in the city, in whatever city you are, there's a little mom and pop dry cleaner. And my idea was there really shouldn't be. There are economies of scale that you could work and you could build it together and create the kind of billion-dollar conglomerate in the laundry dry cleaning industry. And I truly believed it then. I believe it now. But it was just really – it was my first real business that was kind of in my hands. And it was a lot of work. It was my wife was my partner at the time. It was taking a toll on our relationship. And so when the money came and the offer came, as much as I didn't want to take it, it was just too good of an offer, and I eventually took it.
You raise money for that business?
No.
Well, no money?
Not exactly. So it wasn't a formal round, but we did have a friends and family round.
Before we started, you said, hey, Andrew, one of the things I'd like to bring up is the challenges or what it's like to raise money as an African-American. What was that part of it?
Yeah, well, I think for the laundry spot in particular, it was interesting because that was kind of my first kind of non-business school chance of raising money. So when I was in business school, I worked for a company called SelectNet. It was a telecom startup that did some kind of technology. Let's put that aside for a second. I was able to raise money because it was me. It was a founding team, and I was just one of a team out there. So I figured, you know, hey, look, I raised the team raised about $15 million. I was a part of the team. I was lead in a lot of those in a lot of the negotiations. So I figured, hey, when I'm going out on my own, I should be able to do the same. It was a completely different thing when I tried it with the laundry spot. And here I am. I had spent I had a decent amount of money. I spent 3 years on Wall Street. I had a bunch of other smart people, I thought, investing in with me. And so I didn't want to go out for a specific equity round, but we did try and go get a loan. So we applied for the loan. We had our assets in order. Everything was there. And I remember the first thing is when I had my business plan, I had everything. We had a door open. The factory was there, and things were actually moving. And the woman from the loan office came in and she looked at it and she was like, she looked at the business plan and she was like, who helped you write this business plan? And I remember thinking,
oh, wow.
I just went to business school. Like, why would you think I couldn't write a business plan, right? And from then on, the interview just kind of went downhill and eventually we got rejected for the loan. And even looking back to this day, I don't understand it, right? We had the capital, right? We had a relatively good idea. We had some traction going. It was going to be, the assets were going to be collateralized by my assets. So there really was no
risk,
you know, obvious reason to turn this down. And I just have to assume that at least, you know, one of the reasons why is because of my race. And I think that's something that a lot of African-American entrepreneurs find. Now, I can tell you that story, and that's a direct story of me going out and trying to get a loan. But you hear countless stories about the same things in when people are going out and trying to raise equity. I think that's a problem that a lot of African-American entrepreneurs are here.
You know, before I move on past the laundry business, I'm curious about your take on it. Why hasn't there been one giant laundry company with branches everywhere the way there is with Domino's? And I see it I see people take shots at it a lot. Like one of the most recent ones is Washio, created by a guy who would like have the Uber of laundry. I use this service a bunch and it's gone now. What do you think about this space keeps it from working?
I think that the biggest problem with the laundry space is that it is incredibly labor intensive. So in order to kind of get it to work, you really have to have a lot of people to make it work, right? It's not like most companies where you get an algorithm and you can kind of outsource it and then everything kind of goes and you have an office somewhere with, you know, 500 employees and $1 billion in sales. It really isn't going to work like that. You really are going to have to figure out a way to. You can automate some of it, but it's a lot of labor. It's a lot of hand work in there. And because you have that labor cost in there, it puts a lot of pressure on your margins. And so if you're going to try and run a business like that, you can't then try and run it as a commodity business and compete against the, you know, the mom and pop, which is might be an immigrant family who are willing to do it for, you know, pennies over cost.
Right? Yeah. All right. How did your life change after the sale?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, because it was kind of like a good side and a bad side, right? On one side, it was, you know, it was a sale. Everyone knew about the sale and people were kind of like, wow, Fred, you know, it was great. You went out there, you started a business, you know, you're now filthy, filthy rich, which I wasn't. So for me, it was more, you know, what do I do next? I mean, I I'd worked on Wall Street for 3 years. All the people that I was working there were like, hey, come back, be a lawyer again. You tried entrepreneurship, you made a couple of dollars, maybe buy an apartment and then come back to work. And so there was all of that out there. It's certainly not something that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I still kind of felt that I lost this opportunity to kind of create this billion-dollar business. So that was kind of in my head.
So you had an exit. You did well for yourself financially with it, and you still felt like I didn't do right. I didn't do enough. There was still this sense of inferiority or something about it.
Yeah, I mean, remember, whenever you go into starting a business, you really are putting 110% of yourself in it. You actually believe that you're going to take this all the way through to IPO.
You're risking your marriage for it to that degree.
Yeah, you're risking everything. Yes. I mean, you know, so anything short of that, like IPO, you know, where you're sitting on there, cover a fortune, is kind of a loss to you. I mean, and I think, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs that have exits feel this way, especially if it's not the exit that they expected. So there was kind of this, you know, I wasn't happy, I was happy, you know, but either way, I was still about, I think I was 30 years old or a little bit younger than that. And I had to start something. I had to do something with myself. I didn't have enough money to kind of live off of it. I had to kind of go out there and it was either go back to Wall Street and work, which I didn't want to do, or start another business. And that's where Media Takeout kind of came out.
I do feel like you've got this entrepreneurial bent to you, that you leave one business instead of going back to Wall Street, you start another. You got this company that we're interviewing you about here today, Media Takeout, and you then go and start another. Later on in the interview, I'm going to talk about Crowdshot, your new video editing software that uses machine learning and artificial intelligence to edit videos. It's just like there is something in you. And I'm wondering, of all the different things that you could start, why start a blog? Why a blog?
You know, a lot of Why people ask me that. I'm not entirely certain. The best thing that I can do is, you know, where you are in life, you're in different stages, right? So when I started the laundry service, I was working on Wall Street and I was sending my clothes to the laundry all day, right? when I was sitting at home with no job and on the computer playing around all day, I was like, wow, you know, this blog thing kind of works, because I was kind of the blog consumer. I didn't have anything else to do but to just kind of sit around and play around on the internet all day. And so that's kind of what drove me to it. I think I'm always kind of looking for opportunities. It doesn't really matter, right? Like, I'm not particularly tied to one industry or one type of business. I'm always looking for opportunities where I can understand it and where I think that I could actually be a customer. And so that's kind of it.
And so this was roughly also around the time when Weblogs Inc., which had Engadget and other sites, was launching. You'd launch a little bit after them. This was when blogs were just becoming a thing. And so were you a consumer of blogs? Were you reading them a lot? Were you reading gossip blogs?
Yeah, what's interesting is while we were at – so we had this kind of whole plan with to grow the Laundry Spot. And one of the plan was to use blog advertising. And at the time, there were a couple of blogs out there that were just starting to get popular, but they really didn't understand how to monetize. And I remember one thing, which was the funny part, is Gothamist, who a blog still around. They just started, and we advertised on them, and they just had their kind of blog ads on the side of the page that used to be there, and they had no other ads on the page. So I remember talking to the guy, and I was like, "Listen, would you mind if I hired a developer and figured out, like, changed the layout of your site and included an ad right in the middle of your site?" He was like, "Yeah, you can do that." So we did that. We actually called up a developer. We actually created a new theme for the site, a theme for the page. And then because we did, we were able to stick a giant ad right in the middle of the page. And that lasted about a month. And then he realized that he could get a hell of a lot more of it from us. So, you know, I was really kind of hands-on involved in kind of the blog advertising even before I was even in there. And so I was able to see kind of the growth in the industry, whereas a lot of people at the time just thought of it as kind of someone in their basement kind of playing around on the internet. I saw that there was a real business here and there's real growth. And so I was able to kind of take advantage of that once I was outside of the Laundry Spot.
I get it. Why gossip?
I'm not entirely sure. And in the beginning, Media Takeout wasn't specifically set out to be gossip. I mean, the name Media Takeout kind of shows where it was, the origins. And the idea was there was going to be some gossip. There was going to be some sports. There was going to be some hard news. There was going to be some, you know, some TV review, TV and movie reviews. And the idea is that all of that was going to be there. And you were going to take what pieces you want out of it. And that was kind of the idea of Media Takeout. And eventually we just kind of like ran off analytics. The gossip was working and we got more gossip and there you go.
I'm looking at an early version of the site. Dude, this looks so much like Drudge Report, except Media Takeout is at the top of it in orange lettering with a Chinese takeout box with the chopsticks in it.
That was it.
How inspired were you by the Drudge Report?
I even to this day, I mean, I am still amazed at how it's managed to stay relevant. I mean, you think about it, it was launched, I think, in like 1996. It's kept the same outline, the same layout.
By the way,
it continues to grow.
Not only has it kept the same outline and layout, he's kept some of the same links to people, to other people's columns. Some of those links, not only are the links dead, but the people who's he's linking to are gone. And so that you're right. That's how much he hasn't changed the design of it.
Right. And it was just, I mean, I always just looked at it and, you know, especially in the internet, in web, everything is about change, right? Like, oh, hey, let's update. And you have people that do that all the time. And I was always just amazed that he never did that. He had something, he knew that it worked, and he kept it as simple as possible and had you focus on the content and not on the layout. And I think that was his winning way. And I admired it. I was like, wow, I think this is great. Besides that, at the time, we didn't have a WordPress. So we actually had to pay to make the site look whichever way we wanted to. And that was a very, very simple and easy and inexpensive way to make a site.
Oh, I see. Right. If you don't have a really sophisticated content management system, then what you probably want is as easy a system as possible. And that's what Drudge had. But Drudge rarely serves up his own pages. He links out to other people's pages. You guys created a CMS, content management software, that actually allowed you to create blog posts, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were totally outside of WordPress. For the first, I think, 2 or 3 years, we had our own content management system, and it was completely different. Remember, there was no cloud, right? So if you were hosting photos, you actually had to host them on a video on a server. There was no caching pages, so you had to make sure that you had a database architect, make sure that your pages were dynamically being able to produce even on high traffic days. So it was a totally different world, just the idea and what you needed to do to get a site up that can host, that can get, you know, 5 or 10 million people on it a month. It cost a hell of a lot more, and it really was a lot of planning before you got to that point.
Now, the more I'm digging into this, the more I see the similarities with Drudge Report. Even the posts that are on your site, like here's one, it's an exclusive. Prominent black minister is gay, exclusive, asterisks all around the word exclusive, and then just typed out like a typewriter typed it out the way that Drudge has when he does an exclusive. All right, I get how you're doing this, and now I understand the design of it. I thought you just did not like WordPress, or I guess at the time TypePad was big. I thought you didn't like it. You're saying this stuff just didn't exist. It wasn't a sophisticated market.
And so yeah, there were all kinds of bugs to it, and it wasn't something that you could rely on at the time. And yeah, eventually it turned into it.
I started Mixergy's blog on TypePad. It was pretty bad. It was so bad. Lots of little issues. You had to actually like redo the whole site every time you published a post, and a pop-up would come up and tell you to wait. All right, yeah. Let me do a quick sponsorship message, and then we're going to come back to the story. Hey guys, the sponsor that I'm going to tell you about is a company called Top Tal. Top is in top of your head, Tal is in talent. When you have an idea the way that Fred did and you need to implement it, you don't always have a tech developer. You don't always have a team around you to go and implement it. And what you could do is basically do what Fred did, cut down your specs and go for the simplest thing, and then you could get a cheap solution, a cheap person to put it together for you. The other approach is to say, you know what? What would Google do? Google would not put the cheapest person they could find on the problem. They would say, who's the smartest person? The person who can take this problem and not just implement it as we, the product visionaries, can see it, but find a way to solve the problem that uses this developer's experience, that uses this developer's understanding of how the platform, the software that we're using works. How do we get the smartest and the best? And when it comes to finding the smartest and the best, it often takes a long time to find them. You need to do a lot of networking. You need to do a lot of job placements. You need to do a lot of interviews. It really is a tremendously difficult task, which is why you see a lot of sites out there now. A lot of companies offer to take your ad and place it on multiple job boards, let you get all these inquiries inside some system that lets you figure out who the right person is. And it's still a lot of work. TopTal is a company that raised money from Andreessen Horowitz because they came up with a unique solution. They decided they were going to test people out ahead of time, only get the best of the best in their network. And so when someone like you, whoever's listening to me, or Fred needs to hire the best developer out there, they just come to TopTal, tell them what they need, and TopTal makes the match. And a real human being will make the match and make sure that you're happy. If you want to try TopTal, they have a special offer for Mixergy listeners because they are created by 2 Mixergy fans. And the place to go to get that is a URL I'm going to give you in a moment. But I want you to know when you get to that URL, you're going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that is, and I want to underline this last part of this sentence, that is in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Go check that out at toptal.com/Mixergy. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent.com/Mixergy. All right, Fred, you had your first version of the site. It was a guy in the Philippines, from what I remember, who created your first version, right?
Yeah. We went on like, I think I went on guru.com, and it was a guy in the Philippines. And okay. He created it for, I think, $300.
Not bad deal. All right. You were basically linking out, actually, just like Drudge Report, to other things, but you also had the ability to write your own posts. You were trying to figure out where the content was. As you said, celebrity gossip became your thing. The analytics were showing that your posts that you guys were writing were effective, or was it posts in general about gossip?
I think that it was a gossip post. Like I said, in the first couple of months, there were some posts that were about news, and there were some posts about, you know, how the Yankees score last night. And then there was gossip, and gossip just kind of worked. I think part of it is because at the time there really weren't that many places out there to get gossip. Now, it's hard for a lot of people to believe when you look at the internet right now and you look at entertainment news, it kind of leads, right? It's kind of the bigger markets. But at the time, that really wasn't the case. There really weren't a lot of the big players out here right now. And a lot of the major news agencies just really didn't cover entertainment news at all. So and certainly not African American entertainment news. So I think
there
was
for the African American audience from the beginning. I'm sensing that you kind of were, but the laundry spot ad in the center of this, which takes a large chunk of the page, it features like a white blonde woman, Kate Moss snorting cocaine is one. Oh wait, Kate Moss snorting cocaine in Nelson Mandela's home. I had no idea that happened. Were you targeting an African American readership?
We were. And I think that kind of goes back to when I was at the laundry spot. So when I was at the laundry spot, we got a lot of press. We got written up in the New York Post and a lot of the local New York papers. We got written up in Vogue. And then right before we sold it, me and my wife got a write-up in Black Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And after all of the different press that we got, and we'd been on TV, we'd been basically in tons of papers. And people would call you up and say that, wow, I saw you in the paper today or whatever. But when we got a write-up in Black Enterprise, it was like every single person that I've ever met called me up. Like my kindergarten teacher called me up and she was like, Fred, I saw you in Black Enterprise. What a wonderful thing. You must be so successful. And it's kind of odd because when I started the laundry spa, I really didn't know I knew I was an African-American entrepreneur and I didn't know exactly how to deal with that. So when we started the laundry spa, all of the kind of imagery that was there didn't necessarily tell you that we were African-American, but it didn't hide it either. So it was all kind of, there was a lot of cartoons in there that were kind of ambiguous race. We did that on purpose because we always felt that if you put out that you're an African-American entrepreneur, there could be some blowback to you. Maybe people wouldn't feel as comfortable sending their clothes to an African-American entrepreneur. And this is the kind of crazy things that go through your head. But when we got the response from Black Enterprise, and I just saw how many people out there were just hungry to see an African American entrepreneur that's successful, that kind of just changed my view. And so when I started Media Takeout, whereas before had I never started the laundry spot, I'd never gotten that write up in Black Enterprise, I probably would have done it just like every other blog out there, like TMZ or the like. But because I had this experience and it was just so big, it was like I cannot, even to this day, and I've gotten write-ups in the New York Times, I've gotten write-ups everywhere. There has never been a piece of media that I've ever gotten that got the response of that Black Enterprise piece.
I'm getting shivers as you're saying it. I think I'm looking at the post. It's just one paragraph about you. The rest of the paragraph's about other people, right?
I'm not even sure if they even had a website at the time. That's
okay. That's so maybe it's not on there.
It was in the actual magazine. It was maybe it was a couple of paragraphs, but there was a photo of us in there, and it was a nice thing. It wasn't by far the best piece of press that I've gotten. But like I said, I saw that it was there. There was a hunger that was there.
I see.
And so when I started Media Takeout, I was like, wow, there is this kind of hole in the market, and there is this underserved African American communities being underserved. One in the blog sphere. But there's a lot of people out there that if they ever saw that I could be successful, would be there to kind of help me along the way. And so that was because I knew those two things were there. It was pretty easy for me to kind of recognize that the opportunity for Media Takeout was doing urban or African-American celebrity gossip.
So Fred, then our producer asked you in the pre-interview, how long did it take you to get anyone to come to your site? It took me months to get over 100 people a day to my site. You said, we had 500 in the first month. It actually grew pretty fast, 50 to 75% after that. How did you get people to come to your site?
I'm not exactly sure. I think I literally sent an email to every single person that I know and begged them to go to the site. And then at the time, you actually, not only were you able to see like analytics, you were able to see the IP addresses. So I knew what the IP addresses were. So I'd know when people were on the site or not on the site. So I'd call them up and be like, you weren't on the site today. So, I would just kind of badger people to go and tell them to tell their friends about it and go on and on. And then we ended up breaking a couple of stories that kind of started to catch wind a little bit. And then I think kind of the biggest jump that we got is Wendy Williams, who obviously is a giant TV talk show host here in the United States. At the time, she was a local radio host in New York, and she was big on gossip. And she would read our stories on the air and tell everyone, I'm not even sure why she did this. And even to this day, I'm good friends with her right now. I'm always wondering, like, why would you like tell people? She'd be like, not only would she tell the story, she'd say, go to Media Takeout and read it. She didn't know who I was. She didn't know anything.
That is curious.
And she just did it. But just out of, I think, she was excited that there was a site out here that was reporting this kind of stuff. And she wanted to support it just out of the goodness of her heart. And even to this day, I mean, that's why I love her so much. I mean, just there's so few people that would do something like that. And she did it.
And you're now friends with her. The people who you used to admire, used to see from a distance, you're friends with. What does it mean to be friends with Wendy Williams? What do you guys? I imagine you guys go to brunch a lot.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we do. But she lives in New Jersey, and she's a really busy person. But whenever we get together, we can talk openly about a lot of great things,
and we can
go back too and talk about like the journey that we've come up through, right? Like, she was a local radio host. Now she's one of the biggest talk show hosts in the world, right? And I was just a small blogger, and now, you know, we're the biggest urban blog in the world. So, you know, it's a journey that I think, you know, and as you, the longer that you're on the journey, the fewer people that there are kind of there that can share those stories with you. So I think that that's kind of builds a relationship too.
Do you talk a lot when you have brunch with her?
Yeah, I do.
You do? Okay. Is she soft-spoken in private? Because she's not soft-spoken on the radio.
Yeah, she's exactly what you see. I mean, she is 100% absolutely the most relatable person that you can imagine. I mean, you don't have that kind of longevity by putting up some kind of a face, right? She is who she is. What you see on TV is who she is. She's a caring, loving person, and glad to be for her to be.
So you guys friend. Still cover gossip about her. Apparently, her son was caught with synthetic marijuana, but she reveals this stuff, so there's nothing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was there.
All right. So then you're starting to get your audience. Wendy Williams is helping you promote. Exclusives are helping you get traffic, which is huge for any content site. Then you have to figure out revenue. You had a hard time figuring out that ads were the right way. It wasn't until your wife stepped in that you did it. Why? What was so difficult about advertising? Gothamist was doing it. All the others were doing it.
Yeah, you know, and it's why I kind of got into the business. So it's, and this is probably something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs go through, right? Like, you know why you went into the business. You went into the business because there is this sort of meteoric growth in advertising. And that's why you did it. But then you kind of get there, and then there's all this noise from all these different places. And there were, at the time, there was a couple of kind of blogs out there. There was, not blogs, but tech companies. There was a company called Delicious. I don't know if you remember them.
I do. Bookmarking site.
Yeah. And there were a couple of other sites like that, and Wikipedia. And they kind of had this idea that we are not going to advertise.
Mm.
Like, advertising is bad.
Yes.
We're going to kind of keep away from it. And what we're going to do is we're just going to get really, really big. We're going to have a really, really large audience without any advertising. And then we're going to sell a company for $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. Right. And that was the idea that was there. And it's silly to even think about it, but remember, in 1999, the idea was just put out a business plan and have no business and then sell your company for $1 billion.
This was after that craziness, but it was still at a period where if you took ad revenue, you were somehow polluting your site. If you did a blog post for money, you were polluting the blogosphere. And
right.
There was this even sense that if you created software, it should be free. Why shouldn't everything be free online, right? And so
right.
I didn't realize that you felt that. And so as a result, you said, maybe I should rethink this advertising approach. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, and remember too, there is kind of like a scale, right? Like, until you hit a certain number of users, like, advertising doesn't really make a lot of sense anyway, right? Like, if you have 50 users and you're going to get $2 in advertising that month or that day, and you're foregoing that $2, you're not really foregoing much, right? So we were kind of at the point where the advertising dollars weren't going to make a lot of money, weren't making a ton of sense. So it was easier to kind of adopt those views. Luckily, because our growth just kind of kept going very fast, you know, and my wife was kind of like, hey, look, we got rent to pay. I changed my mind just at the right time, and it all worked out.
I see. You started placing ads. Was it Google Ads that you were doing first? Their AdSense
so
product?
It was AdSense, and then there were a couple of kind of AdSense-type products that were out there that we were running also.
Right. I forget the networks that were doing it. Not Technorati, but there were a handful of other networks, right?
Yeah. I think Tribal Fusion. And
right. And then they all got swallowed up.
Right.
And so do you remember how well you did? Because at the time, there were bloggers. I think even Jason Calacanis, who has been here on Mixergy a couple of times, I think he even held the check saying, look at how much money I made from Google. Were you doing good money from that?
I think I was doing okay. This is about 6 months into the business. So in 6 months into the business, I was making enough to certainly cover all expenses and to cover our living expenses and to actually save. So I was making a good living off of it. It wasn't a fantastic living, but remember, the idea was that it was growing at, you know, 50 to 75%, and it was essentially growing the bottom line too, right? Because it was, you know, as if you grew your traffic 50%, you essentially grew your checks 50% too.
What about this forum that you had? How did that do for you? Do you still have a forum? I don't see it on the site now.
No. We had a lot of things in there. So we had a forum, and the idea was always kind of, and this was in the beginning. Remember, in the first year, you're kind of trying a lot of things, and I still was never really comfortable in the first, I think, year that it was a true content media company, right? I was always thinking that there's some kind of way to kind of get some technology in here to work it so that it can kind of, I can kind of collate all the stories from users, and it would get kicked to the front page, and there'd be an algorithm that kind of works it. That was always my thought process. Mm-hmm. And that was always like,
software,
this is going to
happen. Not content.
Right. And so the forum was kind of like the first start in this kind of to get a lot of the stories off, to get stories kind of bubbling and percolating in the forum. And then there was going to be a software algorithm that was going to pluck it from the forum and put it on the homepage. But it never worked out. The forum never took off like I thought it would. And the stories were always there. They kept on coming. And that was kind of the driver of traffic. So, you know, I think it took about 9 months, 10 months, maybe even a year before I formally said, this is not going to ever be a software company. This is going to be a traditional internet media company.
Okay. Didn't take too long to get to that point. Then you needed to start hiring writers. What was your process for hiring writers?
Yeah. So for us, at the time, it was, the biggest problem was the majority of the writers that were out there were magazine and newspaper writers. And they kind of had, especially the magazine writers, had to write, you know, 2 articles a week or something like that. And so I had to convince them to write, you know, 15 articles a day or whatever it was. And I just couldn't find anyone. I could not find any traditional journalist that would do that. They were just like, no, this is not journalism. This is not the way it's done. And so I was just hiring people that were, sometimes there were people that were on the site a lot, or sometimes there were people that I just knew really loved the content. And whether or not I hired them or whether or not they worked for Media Takeout, they were going to be reading this stuff. They were going to be talking about it. They were going to be doing it. And that was the kind of hire that I was looking for. It wasn't so much where you went to school, how you wrote. It was more so kind of how like elbows deep were you willing to get into this content. And if you were, and you had a reasonably good work ethic, I'd bring you in and we'd kind of try people out. And I think the first couple of people, we got lucky with our first hire, who's actually still with us today. Wow. But the first 3 to 4 people, you know, we got a couple of weirdos, as you could imagine, people.
Because you're not paying that much. This is the days when Gawker was paying $20 per post and trying to get people to post, I don't know what, 10 a day. I don't know if those numbers are right, but that's essentially where we were. Right. And that's what you were paying. And you're nodding. Is that true?
Well, no. So what we were doing is something a little bit different. I think Gawker and Nick's approach was kind of bring in a bunch of people and then have them just produce a whole bunch of content and kind of, and the idea would be that, you know, some good content would come out of it and some not so good content would come out of it, and there'd just be a lot of it there. We weren't about kind of creating a ton of content. We were always really specific about collating it. We realized that people have a specific amount of time on the site. They're looking at, you know, somewhere between, I think at the time it was something like between 3 and 4 posts a day. So if you produce 50 posts and the average person is looking at only 3 or 4 a day, you're really just wasting your time. You're better off just producing 5 really good ones and trying to move that from 3 or 4 to 4 to 5. And, you know, and that was always the concept. It was always quality over quantity. And even today, you know, there, you know, when we publish, a lot of times, you know, you see most sites, they publish 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 times a day. We still publish once or twice a day. And that's kind of completely the opposite of the way a lot of people in the industry do it. But it still kind of comes back to this. If people are on average coming to your site once a day, then why are you publishing more than once a day, right?
Well, the reason at the time was you don't know what's actually going to hit. Google was going to index all of your stuff. Every new post was another potential like warrior going out into the battlefield to bring in, you know, to bring in the money, to bring in the eyeballs. And so you didn't have that approach.
And no, and I think that I still think that approach is wrong even today. And a lot of people are take that approach, especially with social media. It's that, you know, you could either sell, you're either selling the homepage or you're selling some piece of commoditized content. And if you're selling the commoditized content, then the value of your brand, the value of what it is that you're offering really isn't there. And a lot of times people out there, and they can get a ton of people on their site, but even the readers don't even know what they're going to, what the site is, why they're going there. You think of a place like the New York Times. Most of the time you go to the New York Times, you don't go there because, you know, you got a Facebook link, right? You go there because you're like, hey, I want to read some news, or this is in one of the four or five places.
I want their sensibility.
Right.
You know, other bloggers at the time also were basically, they weren't breaking stories. They were just trying to take the stories that were out there and find a hook that would make it interesting to their people. You were trying to break stories a lot. How do you get writers to learn how to break stories when they don't come from journalism?
And I think that's, you know, it gets harder and easier in a way. At the time, there was no social media. Now it's a lot easier, right? Like if you just kind of go on social media, go on Twitter accounts and Twitter feeds and just kind of look and see what's going out there, you can get an idea of what's going on without.
Yeah, you guys have this post that's big right now on your site about, there was some Caribbean event. I can't find it fast enough, so I'll describe it. Some Caribbean event going on in Toronto. There was a woman who was being mauled by a bunch of guys, and on Twitter the big question was she raped or was she enjoying and being part of the event? And you guys didn't even host the video of it. You just told about the story, talked about the hashtag, and then there were links directly to the raw videos on Twitter, which, boy, right, was that raw. And that's the way that you're talking about now news gets broken. Somebody finds it within the mess of social media.
Right. And that's, so nowadays it's a completely different animal, right? Like all the stories are there if you know where to look for them, right? Because especially, you know, most millennials, they're out there when they see something, they're either tweeting about it or they're Facebooking, putting it on Instagram or talking about it or whatever. So it's all out there. You're just now trying to collate it. At the time it was difficult. It was different, right? That you actually had to go out there and find what's going on. But at the same time, there really weren't that many places out there that were doing what we were doing. And I'd say that you know, when you look at where blogosphere right now has gotten professionalized, at the time it really wasn't. So there were people out there that were running, like our competitors, that were fans. They'd be like, a Beyonce fan would be like running a competitor site. And so they would only tell fantastic stories about Beyonce, no matter what. And Beyonce would call them up and be like, hey, thank you very much for writing this great story about me.
I didn't realize she would do that. That's smart. Yeah. Okay.
And so this is the way it would kind of work, right? Like they'd be fans and you know, they'd invite them to like album listing parties and like invite you to dinner with them and let you sit down and talk. And that was enough for most people to just really just say, okay, well, if they're going to do this for me, I'll just stay out of this gossip world because that's going to not ingratiate myself to them. And so I'm just going to, you know, that's just the way I'm going to work. But I was professional about it. I was like, this is a business. This is how we're going to do it. There are people out here that are looking for this. There's a market for this. And this is what we're doing. And so I don't care what, you know, anyone else says. I don't care whether we're making friends or not. We're out here trying to produce a product for the consumer. And the consumer is people that are reading Media Takeout.
So how did you break stories?
So we would talk to people directly. So a lot of times, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people won't believe this, but a lot of times you can break stories with the subject of the story. So a lot of times
you can't call Beyonce up, right?
No, I can't call Beyonce up, but I can call up a lot of people and you can ask them, you know, you can ask them for stories. I can call up people and say, hey, you know, send me some photographs. I saw that you're looking good. Why don't you send some photographs of your new hair, or send some photographs.
Got it. Well, I see. So for example, one of the posts on your site, I'm looking at it now, is comedian Tracy Morgan shows off his new hairstyle. Dude is wearing a lace front like Black China. Got it. And so that's the kind of thing that he may not have a hard time sending you. If you just messaged him privately back then, you'd say, hey, anything interesting going on? New outfit, new look, any new place that you're going to? He'd say yes. He'd send it to you. You guys would promote it by finding some way to hype it up. He gets some benefit, you get some benefit, your audience gets a fun experience.
Right. And we would do this over the course of months and years. And so we'd have real ties to the managers. And then the manager, let's say we did it with Tracy Morgan. Then Tracy Morgan's manager no longer manages him. He now manages Dave Chappelle. So now we have a relationship with Dave Chappelle. And the manager understands how we work and how we do things. So it just, over time, a lot of these relationships begin to build. And remember, you don't have to break anything too crazy every day, right? Like you just have to try and produce interesting content that people would be interested in consuming.
I'm a little late to the ad. I want to read it, but when I come back, I've got to ask you how you keep track of your relationships with the celebrities, with their managers, especially when some people on your team might move on, some people on their team might move on. I read a book about Jay Leno, and I saw that it would take them years sometimes to get a guest. There must be some system internally that you use, that they use, that allows you to do that. I want to find out about it, and I know this is a geeky, like, businessy question to ask, but that's what it's about when people do it right. But first, let me take a moment to tell people about ActiveCampaign. Do you know ActiveCampaign by any chance, Fred?
I don't.
Oh, dude, I'm going to open your mind to something new. You're really good at web stuff. How good are you with email? Do you guys collect email addresses?
We do. We don't know what to do with them.
Ah, brilliant. Okay, so here's the thing. What most people will tell you to do is to use some standard email system that just sends out messages saying, here are the top stories. The problem with that is I may be into celebrity music. You may be into business news. Someone else might be into something else. And you don't want to ask necessarily what news do you want. You don't have to. What ActiveCampaign will do is allow you to, like, see what are people clicking on most. So if I click over and over on celebrity news, you might actually start shifting me towards content that's just celebrity news, because, you know, that's what gets me to click. But you don't have to do that even. You can even see what am I doing on your site. So if I'm a subscriber and I keep zeroing in on this type of celebrity news and you see that there are a bunch of people who are doing it, why not create content just for that and send out email just to people who keep going into your celebrity news section, and content to people like you who might go into the business section, send them just the businessy stories. That's what ActiveCampaign is about. They do this because marketers need tools like this to identify who's a potential customer and send them a message, maybe with an extra 10% discount, or find out who's already a customer and send them a different message. That's marketing automation. Fred, whether you use them or not, I really urge you to take advantage of this. It is so freaking powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something I want to look into.
And the reason, guys, that I'm promoting ActiveCampaign is, first of all, it's working for you. I did a few test ads earlier in the year, and people have been happy with it, and ActiveCampaign is happy with how long subscribers stay. But beyond that, it's a simple-to-use piece of software that allows you to do everything that I'm describing and so much more, tagging, organizing, systemizing, following up, and so on, in an easy-to-use way so that you can do it and you won't have to hire tons of professionals to do it, so that when you bring in other people to help you with your marketing automation, you don't have to, you know, send them out for training for years and years. They actually can pick it up and run it for you. So if you're interested in this, they're giving Mixergy people a couple of things that will make it easier for you to use it. Number one, they're giving you 2 free one-on-ones with their consultants so that you can actually think through how to implement it and know that you're implementing this right. Number two, second month free, not much more to say about that. And as a bonus, they're also going to migrate you for free. So if you're with a simple software that doesn't do any of this, they'll migrate you over. If you want to try it out right now, you can try it for free, limited time. Go to activecampaign.com/Mixergy, activecampaign.com/Mixergy. And when you do, just scroll down about 75% of the way down that page, and you'll see on the right side, they have this flowchart that will really help you understand how marketing automation works. One image will capture the whole thing. All right, activecampaign.com/Mixergy. So Fred, what do you do to keep in touch with these people properly? Is it like a CRM? Is it a methodology? What am I missing here?
Well, I think for me, for the most part, it's usually one-on-one relationships. So with most of the celebrities I know, I usually have a relationship directly with the celebrities, and then I might have a separate relationship with the manager and a separate relationship with a publicist. And so most of the times that I actually get content, it's usually directly from the celebrity themselves. And the problem with that is it's like layers upon layers of stuff, right? Like the publicist might say, hey, we might not give that photo to media takeout. We don't know exactly what they're going to do with it, right? And obviously, if the publicist were to give them a photo and something bad has happened to it, it could be his or her job, right? Whereas a celebrity kind of understands the nature of this, of what we do. Remember, we publish every single day. So you can, if you're mad at us today, you might be friends with us tomorrow, right? You're never really mad at us for a very long time, because we could always turn that relationship around pretty quickly. And so, you know, over the years, you just kind of meet people. And especially when you've been around a long time, right? You know, most people don't kind of hit the stage, you know, or hit the celebrity world as an A-list celebrity, right? Usually work your way up. And when they're kind of at that D level, or they're kind of new celebrities, and they're, you know, they're fresh from, you know, they were media takeout readers, and they were, you know, they were out here trying to work on their craft, and they're trying to do everything that they want, they can to kind of get publicity. And a lot of times that's where we build the relationships, and they just kind of sustain as they get bigger.
You know, that's something that I'm missing at Mixergy. When I ask other people who have blogs that are tech-centric how they get this big star, they say, well, we first featured them at a small event, and then we did this post when they launched, and then another one when they did that. And so they kind of feel like they owe us, and so we're asking them and they do it. But do you personally have like a CRM for keeping up with all these relationships? Do you have something that allows you to stay in touch? No, it's just you.
No, it's part of my job, right? Like it's,
and that's why I'm surprised you don't have software that manages it, that you just have to remember, you know what? It's been a while since I reached out to Tracy Morgan's people. Let's go see what he's up to. That's the way it works.
Yeah, basically. I mean, a lot of times too, it's like sometimes it's just something comes up. I mean, we're looking at photographs every day. We're looking at hundreds and thousands of photographs every day. And sometimes you'll see a photograph, you'll be like, oh, they have something coming out. You also, you know, there are movie premieres that you get invited to, and you see them. So you kind of understand where what the schedule of everything is. You'll realize someone has a movie coming out or an album release coming out.
Do you enjoy all this? Like, you're getting to meet celebrities, go to premieres. You do.
I don't, that part of it, I don't really like anymore. I mean, my wife loves it, right? Cause she goes to like the MTV Music Awards, and she's like, wow, I'm here. Look at all these great people. But for me, it's a completely different environment, right? Like I go there and now it's, you know, meeting with Usher's manager, and then a meeting with, you know, this filmmaker. And it's just over and over and over. It's just business after business after business after business. It's like the worst place for me to be. Like,
on the day of the star power of it is not great for you. You're not drawn to it. On the other hand, it's a bunch of work meetings, like a conference for you.
Yeah, it literally is like that. It's like going to like the conference, and the worst conference possible, because everyone is kind of coming at you at the same time. You can't really say no to anyone. You never really can get any work done, really, because people are just have to, a lot of times they're drunk or high. So it's, you know. So it's
your relationship
like
with your wife now must be great then.
Yeah. She every once in a while we'll go to like an event for her, and I'll just kind of like put up with it.
Can I ask you something man to man?
Yeah.
You're now a celebrity in your own right. You get around these celebrities. Do you feel like, dude, I could have had this like experience. I could have dated so many women.
You know, it's not really, because like when you look at things differently when you see it. I'm like, I see the sausage being made. So when I see a celebrity person, you know, some of the people that I think a lot of people think are the best or the most, you know, the most attractive people, some of them inside are not very attractive.
I'm not saying spend time with them on the inside. I'm saying, do you remember that song by Shaggy? Can I get a rain check? Just 21 and I'm not ready yet, or whatever. 29, I'm not ready. Right? Like, do you feel like, dude, look at all this. Give me just 1 year, honey.
Let me tell you. I'll give you a perfect example. So I'm completely straight laced. I have my wife, my kids, and just kind of do it right. I had a friend of mine who ran another business very similar to mine, and he actually lived that life. So he was going out. He was dating all the celebrities.
Yes.
He was popping bottles every night. He was doing all of that stuff. And it really just ran him down physically, right? Like, you can't really live that life for the longevity, right? Like, maybe it's if you do it for like a week or 2 weeks or whatever, it'll be fun. But if you try and do that for like a year or a lot, it really runs you down. And eventually, it could take your life too. So I look at things a little bit differently in that sense. And at the end of the day too, it's every time that someone is let's say a celebrity wants to be a friend, right? That friendship usually causes a complication in your business that might eventually end up losing you money. So I try and keep very few celebrity friends. There are a couple that I have that are friends, and I can tell you that those relationships are never fruitful at all for the business. In fact, they're bad for the business in a lot of ways. So
because you have an example of something bad that happened because of a celebrity relationship.
Yeah. They'll call you up and they'll say, hey, look, you know, something will happen and the whole entire world will be reporting on it. And if you report on it, they'll call you up and say, hey, listen, I thought we're friends. How can you say this? And my response is the whole world is saying it. TMZ saying it. Like, if we're not saying it, we look like weirdos, but to them, they're just like,
well, would you break a news story about a friend that was horrible, but the rest of the world had not known about it yet?
And see, that's come up a couple of times too. And in those cases, you don't, right? Because this is a person.
Because, oh, I see. And that's where it hurts your business.
And that's where you're like, why am I doing this? Right. I can only say fantastic, great things about you, but that's just not the way of the world, right? Or then even more, they'll say, why don't you just write this great, fantastic things about me? And it just is boring. It wouldn't normally make the cut. Now you're adding content there that shouldn't normally be there. So either way, like the me injecting myself into that world is never a good business decision. I've seen a lot of people do it. It's never worked out, in my opinion. And in the, to the extent that I do have those relationships from a business standpoint, not from a personal standpoint, it's great, right? These are my friends. But from a business standpoint, it's not a good idea. So
I get it. By the way, your site is so freaking compelling. I cannot keep it up on my – even if I don't know who the person is or don't like them or don't care about them, I know if I click the link, you guys aren't going to hold back. It's the shock value will be there. It's not like here's a crazy headline and when you click over, there's a story about it. You'll show the freaking picture. You'll continue with the freaking story.
We go all the way.
I'm going to go one tab over to the left from your site to this Inc. article that was written about you in, let me see when, December 3rd, 2009. The headline says, "Building a Hugely Profitable Blog." I did a search for the dollar symbol, and I came up with two references to money. $19.99 for a Yahoo account is what it costs you to start out, and $7.99 for a domain name. I don't see where this high profitability is. Inc. wrote an article about you saying you're really profitable. They didn't ask you the one question that would help them understand like how true that headline is. How much money are we talking about?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people, especially when you're privately held companies, you don't really talk about that because there's no, I mean, if you have investors and the like, it's fine to talk about it. But for me, there's no real benefit to me to talk about, you know, how profitable you are. I can say that we've done very well. We've continued to grow.
Can you give me a sense of revenue? Are we talking about $5 million in revenue, $10 million more?
Like I said, I can't even do that. I can't because
it's finally become a millionaire. Never mind on paper, a real millionaire in the bank.
Yeah, things have been good. Yes.
I see. You said yes, and then you said things have been good. Can I take the yes as a yes?
Yes, let's take it as a yes.
That's phenomenal. All right. Okay, so then you decide, you know what? This is going well. It sounds like the business is kind of running itself at this point, right? It still depends on your relationships, but you don't have to hit the publish button on every post the way you did in the beginning. And you start this thing. What is CrowdShot?
Right. So CrowdShot came about in an interesting way. So we've been kind of doing media takeout for about 10 years. And the idea was, hey, let me go out there and start investing in other companies that I thought had technology that was interesting, and we could use kind of leverage the audience that we have and the relationships we have with celebrities to kind of get the technology, get the technology to consumers. So that was the idea behind it. And I ran into some technology that I thought was incredibly compelling. And after a little while, kind of we were talking to the people that were creating it. Eventually, I decided to partner up with them and start another company, and that's CrowdShot. So
what's the URL on that one? I've been trying to Google it, and I get nothing.
It's www.crowdshot.com. I think you just see a coming soon page or something like that. I'm not even sure.
Maybe that's why. Maybe that's why Google's not showing it up high. Okay, and it's not on. You're not on AngelList, are you?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I see. CrowdShot. So it is coming soon. So this is an investment that you made. How active are you in it day to day?
No, I mean, it was an investment, but I eventually ended up bringing on the entire team that was working on it. We have a small team now that's been working for about 2 years on this video editing technology. It uses artificial intelligence and machine learning so that you can edit multiple videos.
Is it aimed at someone like me if I have multiple videos? Is it aimed at someone who's doing television work?
Yeah, so I mean that was kind of the idea. That's kind of where we were, right? Like the technology was there, and the idea was who is it that's going to use it, right? Initially, we thought about using it for concert video footage, and that's the way the initial idea behind it was. You have all these people that are at a concert. You can all hold up your phones, shoot that Taylor Swift concert, and then everybody kind of uploads it together.
That's why the crowd and CrowdShot exists,
right?
Okay, and then what happened to change it?
Well, you run into a lot of licensing issues and intellectual property issues that just are going to cause an entirely big headache for the company. So we decided to kind of scrap that idea, to leave it concert footage, and instead focus on, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying before, is, you know, where I am as a person, right? When I started the laundry spot, I was a guy who was, you know, sending all my clothes to the laundry. When I started media takeout, I was a guy sitting at home without a job, playing on the internet all day. Now I'm a father of three. And when I look at the videos on my phone, most of them happen to be of my kids and doing kids kind of stuff. And so that's who we're focusing it on right now. We're looking at parents, students, schools, to create a safe place and a safe micro community for them to kind of upload their videos, to share them, have them edited in a safe, engaging, and fun place.
I see. So I would take videos of my kid, which usually I try to keep it short. In this case, I don't have to. I take a bunch of them. You take out the most interesting things and you put it together in one clip that then I share with my family.
That's one way of using it. But the other way is, so let's say that you are at your kid's softball game and you're there and you're there photoing and you're videoing it and you're having a great time. And there are also seven other fathers that are there that are shooting it from different angles. Maybe they're shooting their kid. Maybe they're shooting a wide angle or a tight angle. Wouldn't it be great if instead of you having just that single video that you had of yours, you actually had a compilation video that shows all the best video, all the best shots of everyone there?
So
instead of having kind of the kind of one angle video that you have that goes in and out of focus and is kind of bumping up and down, you'd have a single footage, a single video that uses all of the best pieces of all of the different videos.
I was kind of hoping you were going to say, hey, Andrew, think about this. Editing this interview is going to be a pain. We're going to give you one way to edit the – it makes sense, right? I want my video when I'm talking, your video when you're talking, but I don't want to have to be distracted by software to do that. But that's kind of a basic use case, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that can clearly happen, right? There's a number of things that it does. Right. One is facial recognition, right? So it can – if we were talking back and forth and doing this and we ran it through the software, it would absolutely cut back and forth to us. But let's say we do – we take it a step further. Let's say that you had two cameras on you there, right? Like you had one camera kind of shooting you and the other camera that had you kind of on the profile. And you wanted to kind of turn and change views. That would work too. So you can and with me on it, it would still work, right? So you can have two cameras on your end, one camera on our end. And eventually what you're ending up with is, and it's something that I think a lot of people don't realize necessarily because we're just in the kind of YouTube era. We're so used to seeing kind of a single video with a single person kind of looking forward,
right?
And a single shot. But when you see multiple angles, you see it's a lot more natural, and it's just the way that we actually see it. It's the way that the news shoots. It's the way that most talk shows are shot. And so when you see what it looks like, you start to understand the value in it.
All right. If you don't mind, let me close out with this. And I say if you don't mind because we already went over and you did me a solid by starting a little later because I had an issue here. We asked you in the pre-interview, if you could teach anything to other entrepreneurs, what would it be? You said, understand the customer. I'm wondering how you do it. How can you understand your audience so well that you can just keep churning out content that they care about? What's the process? How would you teach me how to do that? How would you teach our audience how to do that?
So I'd say you really have to start thinking like the customer and spend as much time as you can really trying to be the customer, trying to understand it, listen to what people are saying. I think on the internet, it's a lot easier, right? Like you can read the comments, you can sit down and everyone that you talk to, ask them what they like about the site, what they don't like about the site. And just really, and try to understand, I think, more so than the obvious ways, right? Like you can send out a questionnaire or you can send out some material to try and kind of gauge what they like and what they don't like. But sometimes there's things that are not said that you kind of have to put two and two together to see, right? So, for example, you might have a person might like baseball and they like football. And then they'll tell you, you know, but I don't like soccer, right? And that's, if you ask them that, they'll say that. But in large part, if this is a person that's a real big sports fan and they are really invested in baseball and they're really invested in football, maybe they don't have the time or the effort or energy or whatever to invest the same time to soccer. But there really is no reason why, if they really are into sports, this is a sport that it's not something new, it's something that's the entire world loves and the entire world is in it, that there might be people that say that they don't like soccer. But based on other things that they're doing, they really might like it. And so the idea is to try and get in as deep as possible with the consumer. And so many times you hear entrepreneurs, and especially when they're starting businesses or even when they've been in business for a while, and you talk to them and they'll talk about all the numbers. They'll talk about budgeting. They'll talk about technology. They'll talk about all this stuff. But they don't really talk about the customers. And you know, when I was investing in companies, that was the thing. It wasn't really hard to find a company with really compelling, great technology. There were tons of companies out there that are like that. that if you want to invest, you can go out there and do it. And most of them, their biggest problem is actually it's getting customers.
Because so how do you guys do that at CrowdShot? How do you understand what your customers are, what they need?
I think part of it is me being one of the customers is kind of there, right? And on the other hand is like we don't know exactly how people are going to use the software, right? So for example, I think people are going to say, hey, let's go take it to a kid's baseball game and go do it. But how do I know that they're actually going to do that? We've taken a bunch of steps to mitigate that. So for example, instead of just kind of throwing it out there and putting up the website and talking about how great it is and going on podcasts like this, which I'm going to continue to do, we've actually gone directly to schools. So we're looking to make partnerships directly with schools. We're going to be partnering with about 20 schools here in the Bronx, in New York. And we're going to talk directly with the schools. We're going to have a person, a member of CrowdShot, talking directly with schools and the students, and try and walk their hands into using this technology and figuring out how what the best use case is for it. And that's kind of like our test, kind of
right in there.
Right. And the idea is, you know, if we can get it to work in those 20 schools and we can go to 40 schools and 50 schools and whatever, and there are 2,500 schools in New York, there's 25,000 schools in the East Coast, there's 225,000 schools, I believe, in the United States. So that's the kind of the way that you do it. And when you're kind of thinking like that and you don't kind of walk in there, I mean, I could tell you that this is exactly what the customers want, but I don't know. Right. And so the idea is to kind of put this in their hands, to show, to give them the access to this technology, and to watch and to see what comes out of it. And what comes out of it, just like with Media Takeout or the like, how I was able to see that the gossip was kind of the part that was percolating. I'm certain that we're going to see a part of this that's going to be percolating, and we're going to be able to put all of our efforts into that too.
All right. The website is, and I don't know if I should even tell people to go check it out, it's mediatakeout.com. Everything, you guys are like Breitbart in that everything is a red headline. What is it with red headlines? Just test better?
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing red and black, and the red ones just tested better. And so we just kind of kept them. And we haven't
even
really...
the whole page is red headlines.
I know.
My eyes can't focus on it. Can you read when you go to Breitbart? Forget about the content. Everything is not just red. It's all uppercase. Can your eyes actually pick up on all the headlines?
I think you're right. I mean, you know, sometimes you don't even realize it. And this is, like I said, this comes down to like understanding the customer, right? Like, I don't know why. I don't know why red does better than black. I can't see it. And intrinsically, there's no reason why it should do better than black, but it does. And so that's just how we make the decision.
All right.
And I'm sure Breitbart
did the same. There's so much else I couldn't cover, but anyone who wants to go check it out can go check it out at mediatakeout.com. And coming soon, maybe by the time this interview is up, crowdshot.com, or maybe it'll just show up at your school. Your kids will introduce you to it. And I appreciate you coming here to do this interview, Fred. I'm also grateful to the two sponsors who made this happen. The first will help Fred or anyone else send out customized email to your audience. It's called Active Campaign. Check them out at activecampaign.com/Mixergy. And the second will help you hire your next phenomenal developer. It's called TopTal. Check them out at toptal.com/Mixergy. Cool. Thanks, Fred.
Had a great time. Thanks a lot.
Me too. Bye, everyone.